You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, March 29th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire on the hopeful death of bipartisan education corporate reform. Meanwhile, the trial of Derek Chauvin, the police officer who killed George Floyd, begins today. And a judge just allowed Chauvin's defense team to use a 2019 traffic stop, for which Floyd was never formally charged, in order to build their case. More on that later in the show. 10 states are dropping vaccine eligibility to 16 years old this week, as data shows that over a quarter of the U.S. population has received at least one dose. Contrast that with how less than 1% of the population of Africa has been vaccinated. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is looking to see if the president parliamentarian will allow for a third bill to be passed through reconciliation this year. All of this could be solved with filibuster reform, but seems like we've hit a snag there. Union voting officially ends today for 5,800 Bessemer Amazon warehouse workers, which activists are heralding as the most important labor fight in decades. The vote totals could take a little while, though. Reports of the LAPD detaining reporters and using violent tactics on protesters in Echo Park have emerged as demonstrations against the forcible removal of LA's houseless population from the park continued over the weekend. Secretary of State Tony Blinken expresses concern about the arrests of politicians who ousted Evo Morales in a coup, calls the arrests anti-democratic. Same old, same old. A 220,000-ton cargo ship blocking the Suez Canal, by which 12% of global trade passage has been wedged, pre-capitalism can breathe easy. And Myanmar military forces have killed at least 90 people in the deadliest day since the coup last month over the weekend, or the killings were over the weekend, as the continued nationwide anti-coup protests are publicly called terrorism by authorities. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, everybody. As you can tell, I am not Sam Seether, but I am in for Sam, who is out this week on vacation. But Matt and I are going to hold down the fort for everybody. So very excited for a week of great guests. We have a pre-recorded interview with Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider done by Sam earlier this week. And then I will be having my own guests on throughout the week. But let's begin talking about the trial of Derek Chauvin. So Derek Chauvin, the police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck for over 9 minutes, killing him, begins today. He has pled not guilty to charges of second-degree murder, or second-degree unintentional murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. And the defense's case for Derek Chauvin is going to rest on basically assassinating the character of the man that he murdered, you know, the victim, George Floyd. Here is attorney Ben Crump laying out how expressly wrong this narrative is, even though it's going to be run with by the defense in order to make their immoral case, and the media will likely pick up on it too, at least right-wing media. Let's take a listen.
They're going to take the playbook out, Reverend Allen. They're going to try to assassinate the character of George Floyd. For Lonis, they're going to call your brother everything but a child of God. And they're going to talk about as much as they can about his record. But his record isn't an issue.
All right.
Because this is the trial of Derek Chauvin.
Come on.
Breaking news. This is the trial of Derek Chauvin. Let's talk about his record.
All right.
His 19 complaints of excessive force by citizens here in Minneapolis. That's what we should be talking about. George Floyd didn't kill anybody. Derek Chauvin was the person that killed George Floyd.
Yeah, and too often people forget that. They get caught up in other elements of George Floyd's past. So let's talk about, just because the defense is going to try to use this, what they're going to bring up in trial, what the judge allowed for them to bring up in trial. There was a 2019 incident where George Floyd was pulled over by police, and the video shows that he didn't immediately comply with the officer's request, and then he swallowed some pills and told officers that he was addicted to painkillers, swallowed 8 Percocets, he said, and the police called an ambulance, and George Floyd was taken by the ambulance there. And so there weren't any real charges filed there. What does the fact that he had an admitted drug problem have to do with his death? Well, they're trying to say that it was really all the his death was caused by his usage of drugs, and not the obvious, what we saw in front of our own faces with our very eyes, kneeling on his neck, burying his knee, Derek Chauvin, into George Floyd's neck. The defense is going to try to make the case that because of George Floyd's past issues with substance abuse, that that was the real cause, or you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that choking the air out of someone's throat didn't lead to his death for 9 minutes, for 9 minutes. And that's what's going to be talked about here. And so Derek Chauvin also, as Ben Crump pointed out, has a history of excessive force complaints and complaints that weren't taken seriously by the police at the time. Over, I think the number was 19 that he mentioned there. Yet, we're going to pick out one moment that didn't even result in an arrest of George Floyd, talking about potential and past issues with substance abuse in order to muddy the waters and assassinate his character in the eyes of the jurors. And I this is a tactic that I'm focusing on because it's worked so effectively in the past against black victims. We've seen this time and time again. And the fact that the judge allowed this, I think, is questionable in and of itself. It is not relevant to the case. It is not relevant to the case. Say the defense wants to make the case that he had too many drugs in his system at the time and that's why he died, which I think people who are looking at this honestly, the choking might have had more to do with it, but I digress. Okay, fine. Focus on the toxicology report. All this old video footage does is attempt to make George Floyd seem like a delinquent or like a person that shouldn't be trusted, basically. And
I mean, yeah.
And not the murderer in this instance. Go ahead.
Yeah, what should be emphasized is 18 complaints in 19 years for Chauvin and involved in 3 shootings. Right. Like that, those are the details people should be emphasizing.
Exactly. That's really what we should be focusing on. But again, this is a well-worn tactic by defense attorneys and by people who are trying to let cops get away with, and not just cops, but white people murdering black victims. That's how they're able to get away with this, is by smearing the character of a victim and the judge. I'm not shocked, but it's obvious in my view that this shouldn't have been allowed. We are going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Sam's pre-recorded interview with Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider will be in your...
First, we'll have a little bit of ads, and then we'll come back to you quickly, and then we'll go back to the interview. But here's Sam with the ads. I know people don't want to miss Sam's ads, so here are those.
Thank you, Emma. You know, you shouldn't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price, and with Harry's, you don't have to. For a limited time, Harry's is offering their starter set plus a free travel size body wash at harrys.com/majority. Look, I've been talking about Harry's for, gosh, I don't know, like 3 or 4 years at least. Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave. They do so at a fair price, still as low as $2 per refill. How do they do it? Well, Harry's bought a German razor blade factory that has been making blades for over 100 years. They have cut out the middlemen. The Harry's design team combined a weighted ergonomic handle with a textured grip and a flex hinge. It is actually one of my favorite parts about the Harry's razor. It's a smart, simple razor. It's designed for delivering a close shave along all contours of your face. There's no gadgets, not all buffed up. Doesn't look like, you know, Rambo strapping it onto his leg. Very sort of classic look. Simple shaver. Doesn't come in one of those big sort of ice fortress little containers that you got to, I don't know, get a jackhammer to open the thing up. And for me, of course, my favorite part is the narrower razor blades and the weighted handle. Those are my two favorite parts. But people talk about the blades themselves and the lubricating strip. You're going to love it. They stand behind the quality of their blades so much they have a 100% money back guarantee on Harry's.com. For a limited time, Harry's has made their exclusive offer even better for listeners of this show. Check it out. New customers can get a special offer and a Harry's starter set and body wash, which apparently Emma's better half likes, at harrys.com/majority. We get a 5-blade razor, weighted Truman handle, foaming shave gel, a travel blade cover, and a travel size body wash. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. If you haven't tried it, go to harrys.com/majority to redeem your offer today. Also, today's show sponsored by Third Love. Third Love uses the measurements of millions of women to design bras with signature memory foam cups, no slip straps, and a scratch-free band in variety of sizes. You've heard us talk about their Fit Finder quiz. And now, Third Love is just launching The Fitting Room. It's a new and improved version of the quiz. And I can tell you, folks, from our two different Third Love triers, right from their testimonial, they both said they've never had an experience where they've had a bra fit better than the Third Love one. The quiz focuses on size, breast shape, current fit issues, and your personal style to deliver bras and underwear that are perfect for you. From classic lace that actually feels soft to their number one rated 24/7 classic T-sharp bra, you can check out all the exclusive styles at thirdlove.com. And now they have something new, introducing Lounge by Third Love. It's a mix and match styles, which are your unofficial uniform for anything you feel like doing. From the couch to weekend outings, it's loungewear that's made to wear everywhere. Plus, Third Love gives back. They donate all their gently used return bras to women in need. They support charities in their local San Francisco Bay Area and across the U.S. Now, to be honest, I don't wear bras. However, from one of our two official bra trier honors, the idea that I had 60 days to try out the bras drew me in. But in the end, I don't think I've ever had a better experience buying clothing online. Certainly not when it comes to bras. The Fit Finder worked like a charm. The choice of styles, amazing. Both the bras I ordered were a perfect fit, and they were incredibly comfortable and cute and subtle. Third Love knows your one true fit is out there. So right now, they're offering my listeners 20% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/majority right now. You find your perfect fitting bra, you get 20% off your first purchase. That's thirdlove.com/majority for 20% off today. Lastly, everybody wants to be in top condition. For me, I want to basically stay as hydrated as possible at all times, but I also want a little energy. Well, when we push our body hard or just feeling down, it's important to take care of ourselves. And you got to do so with the proper vitamins and the proper nutrients. And like I say, the proper hydration. That's why Liquid IV created Hydration Multiplier plus immune support. It maintains and strengthens your immune system. Hydration Multiplier plus immune support is a cutting edge blend of vitamin C, zinc, and Wellmune in convenient single serving packets to help strengthen your immune system. The blend is powered by cellular transport technology, which is designed to enhance rapid absorption of water and other nutrients. Each packet is bursting with fresh, natural tangerine flavor. It tastes delicious, and it just makes you feel better. Liquid IV can provide 2 to 3 times more hydration than water alone. With every purchase, Liquid IV donates a serving of Liquid IV to someone in need. The company has donated over 10 million servings globally. Emma, huge fan of I'm actually looking at a box right now of Liquid IV on your counter of your host desk. I'm not even saying the drink. She has the whole box there. Meanwhile, any day that you're watching this show, you know, right off camera here, I have my bottle of the Liquid IV. I tend to go with the energy. But the immune support, it's good when I'm starting to feel like maybe I got a cold coming on. Maybe I've had a little too much to drink the night before. You can get your Liquid IV's Hydration Multiplier Plus Immune Support in bulk at Costco, or order online and get 25% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use the code MAJORITYREP at checkout. That's 25% off anything when you order and you get. Use the code MAJORITYREP. 25% off anything you order when you get better hydration today using that promo code MAJORITYREP, not Majority Report, MAJORITYREP. At liquidiv.com. Now, back to Emma.
Thanks, Sam. yeah, I'm actually drinking Liquid IV right now. But on to Sam's interviews, and then we will be back. Fun half with myself and Matt. Many, many fun times to come after this great interview that Sam did.
We're back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report, on the Zoom, as it were. A pleasure to welcome back to the program historian Jack Schneider, and welcome to the program for the first time journalist Jennifer Berkshire. They have written a book, A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door, and have a podcast, Have You Heard? Jennifer, Jack, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us.
Good to be here.
So let's start. Jack, with some history, I guess. I mean, your book outlines and tries to make sense of what appears to be a disparate set of policies, approaches to education reform. And we're talking about what some people refer to as the corporate reform movement that has been in many respects, the law of the land, literally and figuratively, for the past almost 2 decades now, a decade and a half, maybe. But let's go back to where these ideas actually originated, because it was closer to 40 years ago that these ideas sort of started to pop up. What was the context and what were the ideas?
Yeah, so if you want to find the origins of some of this stuff, the best place to go is actually even further than the Reagan administration, which you were just alluding to from, you know, about 40 years ago. And you've got to go back to Barry Goldwater's campaign for president, which energized a sort of a new grassroots radical right that, you know, it radicalized Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, who had been a Democrat, an FDR Democrat, and who ends up becoming the Goldwater conservative that Goldwater himself could not be, right? Goldwater was crushed by Lyndon Johnson, but the ideas that he normalized in his campaign for president were ideas that by the time Reagan ran for president had really entered the mainstream on the right wing. And Reagan did even more to normalize some of those ideas. But interestingly enough, Reagan's ideas about education were quite unpopular. The American people were not ready to hear that Reagan had a vision of funding kids rather than schools that might devastate the public education system that so many Americans rely on and value. Americans were not interested in that. They were not interested in the idea of moving religion into public schools or moving kids out of public schools into religious schools. Certainly some people were, but Americans broadly did not buy in to these policies. Flash forward to the present, and we have seen tremendous progress by the radical right to lay the groundwork for policies that Americans still generally don't favor when they know what's actually being threatened here, right? The language is far more anodyne than the policies themselves, right? They don't say we are setting out to destroy the public education system. They don't say our goal here is to eliminate teaching as a profession and transform education into a product that is purveyed by gig workers, right? That would terrify people. Instead, they talk about giving people choice and empowering individuals and allowing people to choose and giving them access to private schools and giving them the opportunity to pursue various options. And all of that sounds more or less passable, but what they actually plan for is the elimination of a $500 billion expenditure that we make every year when you combine federal, state, and local expenditures on education.
Jennifer, when Jack says fund students as opposed to education, and I'm not exactly sure that's the exact way that you put it, Jack, but it was some, what explain what he means by that.
So the buzz phrase that you hear a lot of right now is fund students, not systems. And we can point to an example that's happening right now. So just this week, West Virginia passed the most sweeping voucher proposal in the country. And basically with no restrictions, it will hand the $4,600 per pupil that West Virginia spends to educate its students in the public schools. That money will go directly to parents who can then choose to use it on whatever they want, right? And so you can see how you're taking the money out of the system, which means the buildings, the teachers, the school boards, the unions, and you're putting it on an EDU debit card, and you're letting individual parents decide this, I want this thing, not this thing. I'm gonna pay for homeschooling, or I'm gonna use this voucher as a down payment on expensive private school. If you know anything about West Virginia, you know that those schools play an absolutely essential role in things like feeding kids, in things like supporting kids who have lost parents to the opioid epidemic. And so the idea that the, you know, really like the radical libertarian right can just sort of roll through West Virginia and get their legislature, which now Republicans have a supermajority, to get them to say, you know what, we're not going to do public education anymore. Instead, we're going to go with this radical market vision. And to me, what's so ironic about it is that just a few weeks ago, the governor of West Virginia admitted that a whole bunch of other right-wing proposals that they've enacted to try to make the state more attractive to business, things like right-to-work legislation and getting rid of the prevailing wage, none of that has worked. It's made, each thing has made West Virginia a more miserable place for the people who live and work there. And this, I think, will top them all.
That's interesting. And I want to circle back to vouchers and really this concept of their definition of public education is public funding of private, parochial, homeschooling, private education on some level. And so I want to circle back to that. But Jack, tell us what the, and I guess just going back to the idea of it being Goldwater, how much of these ideas were born out of the civil rights era or a response to the civil rights era? I mean, I think, you know, the motivation for these things can change over time, but at that time, this is, it's really hard to escape the idea that this isn't a blowback from the idea of segregating or integrating schools, rather.
Yeah, you're right, right? It doesn't come out of nowhere, nor is it just pure ideology, though we do want to, you know, take seriously the ideology that frames any government as a problem, that frames any taxation as a misstep, because that certainly is a part of this, right? The idea that we tax Americans in order to operate what is essentially a government service at a massive scale. So pure ideology does play a role here, but then you're right that the context of what was happening in the 1960s absolutely framed the kind of radical right-wing pushback that you see in terms of a Goldwater approach to education, which later becomes adopted as a kind of de facto far-right approach to public education, right? Why should I pay more in taxes, goes the argument, so that those tax dollars can go to pay for somebody else's education, right? Why should my kid have to be moved around to some other school that I didn't choose? Why should my kid have to learn things in school? And, you know, here we can see the present context of the kinds of culture war that Donald Trump was trying to stoke, rearing its head again, right? Why should my kid have to learn the sorts of things in school that run contra our family beliefs about, you know, race or class or America? And so this idea that, you know, there is a backlash to any sort of, you know, widespread policy victory is a very real one. And the victories of the civil rights era produced blowback in terms of a response to racially integrated schools, fully funded public schools that rely more heavily on the equal distribution of tax resources. Certainly the professionalization of teaching, because if you're going to fully fund schools and if you're going to serve kids well, then you are going to need a trained and professional workforce. That anti-unionism had already been a part of the radical right's response. But then when you see how over the years labor has been really decimated and yet teacher unions have remained pretty strong, you can see how that context then shifts. And, you know, racially integrated schools today are less of an impetus for the ire of conservatives. But the fact that public education is a bastion for organized labor certainly draws the anger of conservatives who want to know why their tax dollars are going towards an enterprise that not only smacks of collectivism and government monopoly, but also this kind of, you know, Soviet approach where organized labor is able to trump the directives of the corporate managers. You know, the whole system just reeks to them of everything that's wrong with America. And they've been after public education for decades. It's only now, after four decades of really carefully laying the groundwork at the state level, that they're beginning to notch these victories.
Jennifer, I want you to speak to, I guess, one of the premises of the book is that there's this sort of disparate, a seemingly disparate set of policies that are, on one level, contradictory. But when you dig down and make clear what you have in the book, the four principles that sort of give rise to these policies, it becomes more clear. But give us a sense of that. And I should also just say, just because Jack, you inspired me to just remind people, the public education system in this country was essentially born out of Reconstruction, and an era when we were basically trying to expand who was included as a citizen of the United States, and an understanding of that is the heart of the public education system, is this idea of inclusiveness and expanding a fundamentally democratic, small d, democratic initiative. But Jennifer, pardon my tangent, divergence there, but tell us what Jack has been describing a little bit, but this sort of ball of disparate policies that at face value don't necessarily seem consistent, but ultimately are.
Well, first, thank you for your tangent. I think one of our frustrations is that it's so hard to get people to see right now what an overlap there is between the voter suppression legislation that's being rolled out and, you know, across the country and these sweeping school privatization measures. And our friend Derek Black has a fantastic new book out called Schoolhouse Burning that really traces that history back to Reconstruction and shows just how essential public education has been to democracy. So I think part of our hope isn't just to shine a light on the movement to dismantle the schools, but to remind people about just how essential public education is to democracy. Now, if you're in a state where, you know, where you have a kind of an emboldened Republicans in particular, if you have an emboldened legislative majority that is pushing really every school choice policy they can think of right now, it's got to be really confusing, right? They're railing against schools being closed, but also expanding virtual schools. They're talking about needing to help kids escape failing schools, but they're rolling out these education savings account programs that have no accountability at all. They're expanding charters. They are, making it easier for teachers without credentials to teach. The list is long and it can seem really contradictory, but one of the main overlaps that we found consistently was the desire to cut costs. That, for example, virtual schools cost a lot less to operate. It's much harder for teachers to organize. You free school from the constraints and expense of a brick and mortar institution. You get rid of that pesky school board. So that cost cutting imperative goes way back and it's always right there. And then another thing that we see all along is that so many of these policies first ask people to consume education the way they would any other consumer good, that you purchase your education option the way you would a car or a computer or a pair of shoes. And then ultimately the goal is to shift the expense of that onto you as well. We're convinced that these voucher measures we're seeing right now are a stopgap thing, that when a state like West Virginia talks about paying parents $4,600, the idea is that eventually K-12 would look like higher ed, where you decide how much you want to spend and a robust loan system springs up to help you pay for that.
Interesting.
And Sam, if I can just jump in and add a couple more pieces here, because I think Jennifer is so good at explaining what's going on right now and how these disparate policies function together to erode the system. I just want to underscore a couple other pieces of the ideology that undergirds these policy efforts. And so she mentioned cost cutting, and I alluded earlier to the war on labor. And there are two more pieces that we should just emphasize here. One is a faith in markets. Markets work and democratic politics don't. That is a fundamental belief here. And so the effort to shift public education into the private sector is not just about exposing it to the potential for profit. It's not just about seeking to try to cut costs by telling people that, you know, it's a private good and they're responsible for purchasing it themselves. And if they can't, they'll maybe receive a subsidy. It's also this fundamental belief that schools will improve if they are subject to markets. And we actually have lots of evidence that that isn't the case, right? Schools are not like blue jeans. They're not like soda. They're not like cereal. They're not a commodity that actually improves when we expose it to the market and when we subject it to things like advertising. In fact, we know that that'll just make parents even more vulnerable because they won't be able to tell the quality of a school, right? Unlike a cereal, which you know the quality of the moment you taste it, right? A school actually takes a long time to figure out the quality of. It can sometimes take you 10 years after you've graduated to figure out what that school did for you. Right. There's one way in which exposing schools to the market could just lead to failure. People could just fall for slick marketing rather than knowing that the schools are all well-funded, which is something we've been long working towards, and that they're all of relatively high quality. Again, something we haven't fully realized, but something we should be working towards. And then the final piece here is just this emphasis on the private rather than the public, that my aims as an individual should be what I am able to pursue in all walks of life. And of course, as you alluded to earlier, Sam, that's not what public education has ever been entirely about. Sure, people can pursue their own interests and talents and abilities inside the schools, but this is something that we do together in this country. There's a reason we pay for it as taxpayers rather than as individuals, right? It's because we have to live together in this society. And in fact, we're all empowered as citizens, and we want to be able to not just live together, but make decisions together and see each other's interests and not just our own. And this ideology actually approaches it the exact opposite way. There's no such thing as society. There's only each of our individual aims, and we should be able to compete against each other to pursue our aims and, you know, hopefully stay out of each other's way. Well, that's not the society I believe in. I think that's not the society most people want. They don't want to stay out of each other's way. They want to learn how to do things together.
Are you channeling Margaret Thatcher? Was it Margaret Thatcher that said that back in the day?
Yeah. And then Betsy DeVos channeled her.
Not a coincidence at all that was her perspective. Okay, so Jennifer, I want to swing back around on those principles that you guys have outlaid and how they sort of like manifest themselves in society today, but I think at this point, as people are listening, they're thinking Betsy DeVos, they're thinking Margaret Thatcher, Reagan, George W. Bush. Many of them are probably not thinking, and maybe some of them are thinking Bill Gates, and we'll go through those folks. But I would imagine that there's also a lot of people who are not thinking Barack Obama. And but Barack Obama's but Arne Duncan, Barack Obama's Secretary of Education, was more or less all in on this, you know, broad philosophy, if not the specifics, and maybe in many instances, the specifics. I think actually the way that I became aware of your book was through a review that Diane Ravitch wrote. And she started off that review by talking about how Arne Duncan, Barack Obama's Secretary of Education, and Margaret Spellings, who was George W. Bush's Secretary of Education, wrote an opinion piece in the Washington Post lamenting that there was a decline for the bipartisan consensus of what needed to happen with public education. Now, from the three of our perspectives, that's a good thing. But it might come surprising to people that there was this or is this bipartisan consensus. Jennifer, just outline that for us, because just, you know, explain to us, like, you know, that that lineage, if you will.
So that's such a good point that you just made, because the argument that we're making is that basically, you know, you can go back to Reagan and before to find what the right wants. But what really changes is the way that Democrats start to talk about schools. And you see this big shift in the late 80s, early 90s, when they really embraced this instrumentalist vision of schools as workforce preparation, and that learning is going to be, that's going to determine your earnings. And so you can go back now and you think, like, stop, Democrats, stop. Don't you see where this is going to lead? Right? Because it ends up, you know, we end up in this corrosive situation where people who don't succeed feel looked down upon and like it's their fault. And then, you know, we have, you know, millions upon millions of people who have to take out money, take out loans to go to college, and many of them don't finish. And so they also feel this sort of sense of failure. So by the time you get to an Arne Duncan, they have this incredibly elaborate theory of change about how, you know, how they're going to raise the U.S. up in the ranks of international competition, how schools are going to better prepare students to compete in the workforce, not just nationally, but globally. And that we're going to measure that all along the way. We're going to see, you know, students they're going to need to do better on the tests. And so that means that they're going to need better teachers. And we're going to determine that definition of better by how good those teachers are at raising their test scores. We're going to have new standards And then we're going to have teachers teach those standards. And, you know, before you know it, you've got this kind of airtight vision. And, oh, there's one, you know, little thing. We're going to need to weaken your unions for the right reason. And so you go back and you look at this and you think, wow, like Arne Duncan really laid the groundwork for so much of this stuff. I blame him for defining schools in a way that most people find deeply alienating, that he opened the door to somebody like a Betsy DeVos, who understood intuitively that parents don't care that much about test scores. And the more you talk about standardized and math and English test scores, the more you're turning them off. And I don't know if you remember, Sam, when he gave this speech and directed his ire at white suburban parents who had an inflated understanding of how smart their kids were. So I feel like a lot of the blame with this vision, really, we can lay at Arne Duncan's feet. And the problem we have right now is that as good as the Biden administration is turning out to be on so many issues, think about their just aggressive approach to poverty. Think about how pro-union they are. But then it comes to education. Very difficult to determine what their vision is. And the first policy they embrace out the door is to insist that students have to be tested this spring. Not a good sign.
Yeah. And by tested, you mean like all the states, I mean, everyone basically said, we need to waive the testing requirement. And they said no. And which now I don't know what it is in other states. I know in New York, it doesn't have the same implications. But it's also just sort of a ridiculous. I mean, it's just one more burden that you're putting on the schools. We got to figure out a way of getting them in and this and that. And it's completely, I mean, the data set is useless. The whole exercise in and of itself is a sheer waste. But let's go back on some level, because, I mean, what Jennifer is describing, Jack, I think many people would say, like, this was, and, you know, you want to go back and tell the Democrats, hey, you're making a mistake. Some of them may not have felt it that way, even in retrospect. This was a, you know, the term gets overused in my opinion, but this is literally what neoliberalism is, right?
Yeah.
Where we are talking about the commodifying education and that the market is the most efficient way to get our goals in this. And this is, I mean, literally a textbook definition of this neoliberal turn, where we're going to turn our never mind the aggregation of funds, but also the democratic oversight of those funds, and the implication that it is for as many people as possible. I mean, those three elements are fundamentally contrary to the idea of commodifying education, right? I mean, you want some scarcity, you want some price hierarchy, you want, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And so, Jack, we have this dynamic where there's this handoff between No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top. And there's also this other element of, like, on a parallel track, or maybe not sort of coincidental, is the Gates Foundation. And right now, over the past, I guess it's about a year, nine billionaires have made $360 billion over the course of this past year, which is basically rivals, you know, the amount of money that we gave to people in $1,400 checks in the last relief bill. One of them was Bill Gates. He has sort of moved on from education a little bit into the realm of, like, making sure that IP is protected with vaccines, because that's the most important thing to him. But it's indicative of how, like, when you're a billionaire and you have the ability to spend $1 billion or $2 billion, like in the way that I would go and say, like, hey, you know, I think I'm going to have a turkey sandwich today. Those whims were all a little bit narcissistic. If I have that kind of money, though, all of a sudden my narcissism about and my ability to know everything turns into, like, a massive force. Will you just talk about how Bill Gates, his project, you know, sort of, like, influenced the trajectory of education in this country?
Sure. I can't resist talking just for a moment longer about neoliberalism, though. You could see Jennifer and I were like bobblehead dolls listening to you there. And I think that it's really important for listeners to understand just how powerful that neoliberal consensus was and that it ran across administrations. It begins with George H.W. Bush, who brought the nation's governors together in Charlottesville in 1989, and who led this effort to create standards in Charlottesville in 1989? Which governor? Well, it was young Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton, who then defeated George H.W. Bush and advanced the national legislation. So we're talking about two pieces of legislation here, Goals 2000 and America 2000, that were essentially Bush-Clinton hybrid pieces of legislation that then finally get moved forward by George W. Bush as NCLB. The Obama administration reauthorized that as the Every Student Succeeds Act. And so we can see here that standards-based accountability, which is essentially corporate-style performance management, right? This is no different than you would see at, you know, an aluminum manufacturing company. This idea that what a business does is it identifies metrics for measuring the performance of labor, and then it exercises top-down control in order to produce the kinds of results it wants, right? So this kind of corporate ethos is at the core of neoliberalism, as is the idea that exposing things to the market will improve them. And so the consensus here was charter schools, right? Republicans might have gone for a voucher, Democrats would not have. And the compromise was public schools that operated in the free market, right, that people could choose. And charter schools were one of the key strategies across these administrations for 20 years. Well, you can see how this laid the groundwork for those who wish to dismantle public education, because you normalize this idea that schools should be something that you shop for. You normalize this idea that, you know, elites are the ones who should be making decisions and managing schools. And in many ways, there's a backlash to that, not to the choice piece, but to the piece which is you no longer are in control of your local public schools. And that's where somebody like Bill Gates comes in. I think Americans are tired of hearing billionaires weigh in on what their public schools ought to look like. And I think that that has driven forward this idea that Americans ought to be able to choose for themselves. Well, what they ought to be able to do is exert their voice through the public system, because the public schools belong to them. But so many of them have felt disempowered in public education. The schools aren't doing what they would like them to do. They don't want the schools narrowly focused on standardized tests. They do like this idea of choice, which has been sold as a panacea to them. And so we are increasingly vulnerable to the allure of a system that is run on the basis of choice. Take a voucher and go to whatever school you want, and you can pursue your own aims there. And we've been encouraged to think of our own aims as something that we pursue in isolation from each other. And so I think this idea of, you know, the billionaire education reformer is most important when we think about this individual as somebody who has shaken Americans' faith in the public education system, that the system belongs to us and that it's a system that works. Because in many ways they feel, no, it's a system that belongs to elites and it must be broken because every reform in the book is constantly being thrown at it. When in fact, we know how to improve our public schools. It's by fully funding them, by pushing for integrated schools, and by, you know, pushing to have our schools do all the things we want them to do.
And we should say too, there's this, I mean, there's a lot there I want, but the, you know, cause I just, had interviewed for the show that we do on Peacock, about these billionaires and their, you know, this concept, this uniquely American concept of benevolent billionaires, which really at the end of the day, I mean, it's easier, I think, for people if they get hung up on the idea of the label of billionaire. Just think of it as more like a king without regional boundaries. They have this authority because they happen to sit on the throne. And, you know, you could argue, well, they earned their throne, but sitting in kings, right? They fielded armies and they slayed their and that's not really what we're looking for, I think, as for a democracy. But the talk about that central premise of our education being bad. Like, I mean, all of this is founded on this notion that our public school system is broken as opposed to needs improvement, right? I mean, because broken implies like it's broken. You can't fix it. We need to abandon it. And that's the whole theory. We're going to close schools in Chicago. We're going to chuck these things away. But in fact, our public education system is not broken by any measure, right? It is overburdened, it seems, with societal ills. And in many ways, the portfolio that we expect out of public education is just far too great, and it's far too underfunded to maybe even pursue its full potential and its primary mission.
I think that the single most positive thing that's come out of the Biden administration so far is that we're going to be giving financial assistance to families with children, right? Like, this is really revolutionary for us, right? All the other industrial countries have some version of guaranteed income for children, but we don't. We rely on the schools. And you can actually go back to 1965 when then President Johnson, pushes through the Elementary and Secondary Education Act and look at the way they talk about how they're going to use education in order to provide for poor kids, for disadvantaged kids. And we've held on to this belief ever since. And the billionaires you were talking about are very wedded to this idea. You can go back and listen to Michael Bloomberg during his short-lived presidential run. There he is on stage in South Carolina, and he's making this impassioned case that education is the surest way to move out of poverty. And as we saw through the passage of the Stimulus Act, actually the surest way is to raise people's incomes, right? And so, but you can see why billionaires who benefited so handsomely from a structure that guarantees ever-widening inequality would prefer something like education to, redistribution. And what we're really seeing now is that pendulum has begun to swing. The gap has become so outrageous that it's really hard now to make the argument with a straight face that schools are the things that are going to fix poverty and inequality. And so what we're left with then is this big question of what is it that we want schools to do? Because all the expectations we've heaped on schools have been so unrealistic that they've really fed that sense of disappointment, right? Like, schools are supposed to fix poverty, but they never do. So that must mean that they're not working. We're at this interesting crossroads, another one where I think we're going to be having a big debate about what it is we expect our schools to do.
Yeah. I want to ask where we are with that, in the context of COVID, in the context of I can't harp on this enough, so I'll say it again. The RAND Corporation was commissioned by the Gates Foundation to assess essentially their $1 to $2 billion investment in education over the past, really in the first decade of the century, but to some extent in the second decade as well. And their own study that they commissioned said, it was wrong. And we should go back and do what educators did. Now, that didn't get nearly the publicity. I think like something like that should have, because that money and that presence implicated, that was a 10x, 12, 20x, 100x return on that money in terms of shaping policy. But it feels like, at least prior to the pandemic, Jack, that reform movement, the corporate reform movement had, if not died, lost its momentum in its power. And part of it, I think, is because it became DeVos as the face of it. And it was a little bit more naked. But even before Donald Trump, there was a sense that it was failing. There was pushback on this. Where are we going forward? And let me just, before you answer that, also ask, in this last COVID relief bill, Chuck Schumer, and I know why he did it, but Randy Weingarten signed on. I'm not as clear on why that. To provide about $5 or $6 billion for private schools to help kids, and ostensibly it was for kids who were low income. to me, that is a big part. It's Chuck Schumer worried about Hasidic parochial schools, frankly. But that's a lot of money and it's sending the wrong signal. So where are we going forward? I mean, the Biden administration on this program, we've said so far, he gets an incomplete. We need to see more work before we make a full assessment. But where are we going? Where is this going as a movement or the counter movement?
Yeah, well, big question there. I'm going to once more take one step back before taking a couple steps forward and say that, you know, the rhetoric of the past four decades has been that America's schools are failing. And it's been rhetoric that has been used on both the right and the left. And it actually runs counter to what Americans themselves believe. So if you look at polling data, the vast majority of Americans feel pretty good about where their own kids go to school, but they'll tell you that the nation's schools are failing, right? Well, what does that mean, right? Both of those things can't be true at the same time, that the vast majority of kids are going to schools that their parents deem to be pretty good, but the nation's schools as a whole stink. And I think this toxic atmosphere has opened up all kinds of opportunities for highly interventionist, mostly wrong-headed reform. And so we saw this in terms of openings for the standards and accountability movement, openings for the charter school movement, openings for reforms led by billionaires. And I think we're finally at this moment where, as you said, Americans are pretty sick of it. Educators are sick of it. Communities no longer believe that reform is the answer. But I think we're in this crossroads because they also have been convinced that American public schools are in crisis, that the system is broken, and that something needs to be done. And so what I would love to see from the Biden administration is very clear messaging about the fact that our schools are not broken, that in fact, we have unfulfilled obligations to our schools and to the children who attend those schools. And that were we to fulfill those obligations, were we to push for racially and economically integrated schools, were we to push for fair funding mechanisms that ensure that every school has what it needs to educate the kids that it serves, were we to invest in the teaching profession such that we were bringing fully trained teachers into the classrooms and we knew that they'd be there for their whole careers. Were we to fulfill those promises, I think we would edge ever closer to this dream of a system that meets the needs of every kid in this country, but we would still need to meet their needs outside of school. Now, will the Biden administration commit to meeting their needs outside of the school or at least take some real steps in that direction? And so I think what we need is to place incredible pressure on this administration to do the same inside of education, to begin moving us towards these obligations that we can fulfill, to be moving in the right direction on those several very straightforward policies, right? Integration, funding, and support for the teaching profession.
Jennifer Berkshire, Jack Schneider, can't tell you what a pleasure it is to talk to both of you. The book is A Wolf at the Schoolhouse Door. The podcast is Have You Heard? We will put links to both of those at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Great to be here. See you, Sam.
And we're back. Great interview, Sam. I'm sure he's listening diligently on his vacation, but that was really fascinating, and I can't wait to check out the book. We have a few minutes before we head into the fun half. Why don't we do a little Trump content? Matt, how's that sound?
Yeah, he's back, folks. We actually get to see this guy. He's still alive. I think maybe we can leave the commentary until after we play this video. But we should just note that it is at Mar-a-Lago, so he's not going to make his return at, you know, a place that he's not going to cash in on. And it is at a wedding for a Florida car salesman. So,
yeah. Just so you guys know, this is not his wax figure from the Disney Hall of Presidents come to life, even though they are sharing the same outfit.
Yeah, visually it really looks like that, but if you listen to it, it sounds like the old Trump that we knew and hated. So.
You know, I turned off the news. I get all these flash reports, and they're telling me about the border. They're telling me about China. They're telling me about Iran. How are we doing with Iran? How do you like that? Well, they were ready to make it. You know, they would have done anything. They would have done anything. And this guy goes and drops the sanctions. And then he says, we want to negotiate now. We're not dealing with the United States. They don't want, oh, no, they don't want to deal with us. And China, the same thing. They never treated us that way, right? You saw what happened a few days ago. It was terrible. And the border's not good. The border is the worst anybody's ever seen it. And what you see now, multiply it times 10, Jim. You would know how to handle. He's the only one I know that might handle the border tougher than me. But we have to. And the tough is in the most humanitarian way, because that's what it is. What's happening to the kids? They're living squalor. They are living like nobody has ever seen anybody. There's never been anything like what's happening. And you're going to have hundreds, and you have it now. They have the airplane photos, the shops, and they call them shops. And these things.
Well, it just goes on and on like that. You know, it's fairly customary when you're giving a speech at a wedding to reference the people getting married. Not really Trump's way. He'd rather just do a rally speech in a tuxedo at a random wedding in Mar-a-Lago.
It's interesting the impulse that he still has. The we do it, we'd be tough, but in a humanitarian way, which shows that that's not really campaign Trump. That's just Trump wanting to make sure he doesn't offend all like the more like maybe the wives in the audience that might be offended by such like naked cruelty.
Right, right. It's also pretty sad because you can hear kind of the bustling of waiters and people eating their food, and all
still a little bit more.
He wants a collection of warm bodies in order to relive the glory days, and yet he's just standing there swaying about with the microphone, doing retreads, slurring old things he used to say. It's like a washed up football star wearing his Letterman jacket at 35 and going back and, you know, doing Jaeger shots with the high school kids in the back of the parking lot. That's the vibe I get.
And also, I wish the Biden administration was being as weak on Iran as Trump is implying.
Exactly. I mean, we're gonna yeah, continue.
Things are showing thousands and thousands of people coming up from South America, and look, it's a disaster. It's a humanitarian disaster from their standpoint, and it's going to destroy the country. And frankly, the country can't afford it, because you're talking about massive, just incredibly massive amounts, our school systems, our hospital systems, everything. So it's a rough thing. And I just say, do you miss me yet? We're saying we didn't get 75 million votes. Nobody's ever gotten that. They said, get 66 million votes, sir, and the election's over. Well, I got 75 million, and they said, but you know, you saw what happened. 10:30 in the evening, all of a sudden they said, that's a strange thing. Why are they closing up certain places, right? You know, a lot of things happening right now. I just wanted to say, it's an honor to be here. It's an honor to have you at Mar-a-Lago. You are a great and beautiful couple. And for many, many years of your
You know, also another good rule of thumb for speeches is you don't just abruptly segue into something that was completely irrelevant. Perhaps he could have been more artistic with this and tried to tie the crisis at the border or the fact that obviously the election was stolen from him into how the bride stole the groom's heart, just like the election was stolen, or how they'll cross into each other's lives, like the massive amounts of illegal immigrants who are crossing the border. I mean, just like make it contextual, dude. Otherwise it's just like, come on, grandpa, time
yeah.
Talking.
Well, what's happening at the border is a massive repudiation of the hard carceral approach on these sorts of things, because it's going to cause a massive backlog. That border crossing should be treated like an administrative procedure, not a criminal one, and that this is what happens when you do that. And both parties, unfortunately, are willing to play into it. And until we can break out of that mindset, this is what's going to happen. So, you know, he can. It's funny him doing what, like, and I obviously I think I don't know, like, the he wants to do it with in a more humanitarian way, like. What would that have looked like? Why didn't you do that 4 years now?
Yeah, yeah. And you're exactly right. Again, he's critiquing just the effects of the small thinking nature of the non-systemic nature of the way the Biden administration is approaching immigration and then also Iran. You mentioned it before we went back to the video, but none of these things that he's saying about the extreme nature of the Biden administration are true. And in fact, they've been center right on immigration, center right on foreign policy. I mean, we're going to praise, and we have praised, the stimulus package, and for the fact that Biden hasn't shied away, and he seems to be doing trying to go big on infrastructure too. But in terms of those two topics, it's been same old, and not in a good way.
Absolutely.
All right, let's head into the fun half.
I need to plug. Because Sam didn't let us plug on Friday.
Now I'm forgetting plugs. That's what happens when you sit here.
Yeah, we had Freebie Friday, and, you know, just kind of apathetically steamrolled right over the plug segment. But last Thursday night on Left Reckoning, people go subscribe to the YouTube channel. I want to see, like, I'm going to go check the analytics. I want to see like 100 people have subscribed. Come on, YouTube chat. You can navigate even off this page if you want for a little bit.
Matt's doing Brendan's out this week as well. So Matt's working hard. Reward him with a Left Reckoning subscription.
Yeah. I want to see a little bump. Cause we had, one Shama Sawan to talk about the recall effort and how to actually take on corporate power at the city level. So she's a great interview with her, and we're going to be doing more with her about, you know, throwing your weight around as once you actually build power. So Shama's great on that. Also, Wozni Lambre, we had a great discussion about the 1964 All-Star Game strike threat by Oscar Robertson. I'm blanking on a few of the other wasn't McAdoo, maybe it was, but and Heinsohn, like those guys, they threatened to not play the All-Star game, which is the first televised one, because the NBA wouldn't recognize the Players Association. And that threat worked, and they got the Players Association. So Woz came to talk to us about that and about why Luka Doncic can toast two of the best defensive players that I name in the NBA, and Kawhi and Paul George every time. So we touched on that too, and also Seattle sports. So I'm getting a little bit of a feedback, so I will stop plugging now.
Well, no, I think you sound fine. I mean, the fact that Luka Doncic is so likable and he's so good, and the Knicks have the Mavericks first round pick this year. So it's like a real tearing at my heart, because I want to root for Luka Doncic, but it's difficult for me this year.
I think I would have not, but he's too good to really kind of, he's too fun to watch.
And, you know, I was like, Kawhi Leonard's arguably my favorite player in the NBA. So, all right. And the Noma Keys show does not air today, I believe, Matt. But check it out, subscribe, check out her show. And we're going to head into the fun half now. Stick around. We have a ton of funny clips, including a breaking Mike Lindell clip. You got that, Matt? Because that's especially nuts.
We will get that.
Awesome.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.